This is Talking Business.
I'm joined now by Peter Costellas, who's the CEO of the Carbon Market Institute. G'day, Peter.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
Carbon Market Institute industry body, who are the members?
So our members constitute a lot of companies who are large emitters, but also professional service providers and the banks, and also a lot of the companies who generate carbon credits and projects around Australia. So combination of buyers and sellers, if you like, around the Australian corporate
sector. And what do you do for them?
Well, we both provide them with both knowledge exchange and commercial interaction. You know, if you're trying to navigate climate change, is very difficult for a business. Trying to create businesses around climate change is difficult. So getting market intel on policy and market developments is probably the primary value we add to our members.
It's an interesting name, Carbon Market Institute, because we're not supposed to have a market in
we're
Australia.
We're not supposed to have a market in Australia and, you know, the
you
legacy
know, we,
of
it.
The...
It all just went away. We were going to have a market, but it didn't kind of happen.
I know, but, you know, the reality is we're actually part of a global market and carbon is a globally traded commodity, and one way or another we're going to be back in the game. So,
do you think we are?
Yeah, I think we are. Yeah, we're a trade-exposed economy. We've got heavy emittance and the, you know, the world under a Paris Agreement approach is going to actually drive emissions down, and one way to do that is to use market mechanisms. So we're going to be playing in that space.
So the National Energy Guarantee, the NEG, is meant to be kind of, I don't know, well, what'd you call it, a sort of an anti-emissions trading scheme. But do you think it will eventually turn into a trading scheme?
I think it's only one part of a policy suite. I think a lot of the energy and climate should have come together in this current government, but we're still only focused on energy. I think once you start bringing in other sectors of the economy, the buyers of energy and how they sort of manage their energy profile, I think we're inevitably going to head towards sort of a market-based approach. It's the efficient way. So from the electricity sector, I think the NEG is one policy mechanism, but to address emissions across the economy, we're going to have to linked policies and linked markets.
So one of the things you do for your members is tell them what's going on around the world.
Yes.
Tell us, what is going on?
Yeah, so the global momentum to address the Paris Agreement is on. We've got the low carbon economy is underway. So
what about the fact that America pulled out?
America's signalled that they're pulling out, but if you look at the businesses that have made the commitment under the We're Still In sort of commitment, and you look at the subnational jurisdictions, a transition to a clean energy economy in America is happening to
electric vehicles. Also, the fact that Trump said he's pulling out is irrelevant, is it?
It's irrelevant. It's about price. If you look at states like Texas and to see the scale of development of renewable energy projects, in a, you know, the oil-rich state. It's an indication of where the sort of market dynamics and economics are actually playing out. So it's good optics from Trump to his supporters to say we're pulling out of the Paris Agreement, but the businesses and subnationals are still in.
And what about China?
China's got, you know, probably going to draw the critical mass of investment in innovation, which if it isn't already, it is already going to be the heart of the global market for innovation and particularly emissions reduction.
But I keep hearing that they and other Asian countries, in particular India, are building coal-fired power stations like mad.
Yeah, they're building coal-fired power stations using state-of-the-art technology, but in terms of the global energy, their sort of suite of their energy mix, the scale of increase in investment in renewables is happening at the same time. So it's a diversified portfolio, but you're getting massive investment in technology and renewables and energy efficiency as well.
Do you think that given the decline in the price of solar PV and wind turbines and so on, that we actually need to have subsidies for renewable energy?
Oh, I think it's one of the things that's driven the innovation in Australia and given us a, you know, competitive edge is the provision of subsidies. So whether we need them into the future, I think we still need sort of market frameworks and long-term policy signals to continue investment. As an investor, it's an attractive option, renewables at the moment, and the subsidies have got us to this place. I think what we need is the architecture of and long-term policy signals to continue to drive that investment. And so clearly subsidies help, or at least a level playing field, I think, helps.
Really? I mean, explain that. I mean, because I do hear, do hear that, you know, the price of building a solar farm to generate electricity is now much less or is less than the cost of building a coal-fired power station.
Yeah.
So why do we need to subsidise it?
So in terms of where, as I said, where the subsidies have got the market to, right, that's actually important to actually build on the future. So if we want to capitalise on the demand.
I'm talking about the future.
Yeah, so if we want to capitalise on the demand, I think we need the policy signal to say how we're going to meet emissions reduction, right? That to me is how the industry can be subsidised by getting the right policy signals. So in terms of actually balancing the cost of a renewables versus a fossil fuel-based generation, if you've got the right sort of long-term trajectory of emissions reduction set in policy, that's arguably a subsidy, but that's what's needed, and we don't have that at the moment.
So a lot of the argument that goes on comes down to an argument about the percentage of renewable energy in the system. Because the federal government's percentage is 26%, and I can't remember by when, 2030?
Yeah, by 2030, yeah, 26% on 2005 levels.
That's right, yeah. By 2030. And but other state governments, like the Victorian government, is talking about 50%, and then somebody else is talking about more than that and so on. So what do you think is a reasonable percentage?
Yeah, look, I think the way to frame it is what is required for our global objective
up
to.
Good.
Yeah, what it's actually our ambition is we need to go to 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees below pre-industrial levels in terms of our reduction, limiting our global temperature increase. And to do that, it's going to require the transition of the whole global economy to a zero net emissions global economy. So if we actually, the targets actually should be very long-term, which is set into the Paris Agreement, which Australia signed up to, which is a zero net economy at some time in the future, sometime in the second half of this century. So that's the long-term target. So what's the transitional targets?
Zero carbon emissions.
A zero net carbon emissions
global economy. So we have to stop eating meat.
We have to offset our emissions. We've got to look at all the technologies to be deployed to be able to do that in a way that's substantial. And that's where Australia's got a competitive advantage. So if you're looking at offsetting, if you're looking at sort of replacing emissions with sequestering those emissions and creating new types of projects that take emissions out of the atmosphere, Australia's carbon farming industry and what we're actually doing in our land-based domestic carbon offset projects put us at the forefront internationally.
Tell us about carbon farming. What is it? And what's going on in that thing?
Yeah, well, carbon farming is really exciting, I think, particularly for Australia. We've got a very significant landmass, and carbon farming really is looking at agricultural projects that actually reduce emissions from those agricultural activities or sequester or take carbon out of the atmosphere.
By doing what?
By, you know, the traditional sort of images like planting trees, right, or regrowing forests, those kind of things. So trees basically take carbon out of the atmosphere. And if you look at our landmass in Australia, we've actually got a very substantial carbon farming industry at the moment. It's a $2 billion industry as it stands. We can do things also.
Do you mean directed at carbon farming or just taking carbon out of the atmosphere by accident because they're doing other stuff?
No, under contract through the government's emissions reduction fund. So there's $2 billion worth of contracted abatement that has to be delivered. So these are contracts to actually deliver the accounted carbon from emissions reduction or avoidance.
Right.
And so we've got many, many players around the whole country, including Indigenous groups, including farmers and other. A variety of agricultural practices that are actually generating credits from carbon farming activities and monetizing those through the government.
I don't think that's well known.
It's not well known. No. And I think there's a real opportunity here now to, let's say, expand the scope of what we're doing in Australia. So when anyone flies on a plane and they tick the box and they offset their emissions, they go to a project that has to be verified for in terms of the carbon offset. Australia potentially could provide not just for the voluntary activity that the punters might tick the box, but for the global demand coming from corporates and from governments to offset emissions. And Australia has the landmass and the deep capability to develop those projects that could supply credits to the world.
Is it viable to become a carbon farmer?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the business case, if you like, for allocating a proportion of your land, there's not just the carbon credit in terms of the environmental benefit, there's other benefits that can be accrued from that. For example, biodiversity benefits or land productivity benefits or herd productivity, as well as things like Indigenous employment in those kind of projects and some social benefits that can be accrued by generating more income on land that potentially is not being utilised in a way that generates.
But can people who have got an orchard, like they're growing oranges or, you know, olives or something, can they also get money from carbon farming?
Yeah, I think it's probably like, you know, at scale, it's going to be more economic, right? So the kind of agricultural holding you have and the type of land that you're going to utilise, clearly you've got to weigh it up against how much value you can get out of other types of agricultural activity. But I think it's where we're going to evolve to is a mosaic where farmers who are already using their land for different types of practices will look at a carbon farming as a proportion of their land. And the models for how you can like aggregate those projects across different holdings, I think they're things that are going to evolve in Australia as well.
Do you think the NEG is worth having?
Oh, look, I think we need a suite of policies, and I think the electricity sector clearly needs something to provide the market signals to drive investment in the transition from fossil fuels to renewables. So, yes, I think the NEG's worth having. I'm not sure it's the most optimal policy, I think, but it needs to work in concert with how you also drive emissions through other parts of the economy as well.
Right. Well, great to talk to you, Peter.
Yeah, thanks, Alan.
Thanks very much.
Appreciate it.
I've been talking to Peter Costellos, who's the CEO of the Carbon Market Institute.